From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. What can a liberal arts college education do for a prison inmate? Goucher College has professors teaching courses in two Maryland prisons.
I had my initial doubts and just thinking, you know, why are they going to care about Latin America? And I was so pleasantly surprised right from day one.
Today we tag along with Tom Hall as he visits classes in the men's and women's prisons at Jessup and talks with some students.
The Chinese philosophy and the Latin American history, it's been a real good experience for me.
Plus, Claudette Sutton's father, Mike, emigrated from the old Jewish neighborhood in the Syrian city of Aleppo to Shanghai and eventually to Maryland 6 decades ago. She's written a book about it, Farewell Aleppo, My Father, My People, and Their Long Journey Home. First News.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We begin this morning with a visit to a couple of unusual college classrooms. In a spacious library, a political science class discusses why some political movements succeed while others don't. In another classroom, the subject is Latin American history. The professors are from Goucher College, but the classes aren't held on Goucher's bucolic Towson campus. They're conducted at prisons in Jessup as part of the Goucher Prison Education Partnership. Tom Hall sat in on the classes last spring.
Both of these forms of politics mobilize ordinary citizens.
Professor Rachel Templer is teaching a class called Understanding Politics. Her students listen intently and quietly jot down notes. 16 women sit in groups of three or four at several large tables that are bathed in sunlight on a crisp April afternoon.
It's within the small issues that they build the power and political recognition that they need to tackle larger issues.
That's Elizabeth.
My name is Elizabeth Starnes, and I'm 43 years old.
Until just a few years ago, Elizabeth had never taken a college course.
I wasn't so bad in elementary and middle school. I failed ninth grade of high school, and I did what I had to do to get by and really had no interest in attending college.
But as of this summer, she's earned 29 college credits.
When I took pre-calculus, I swore up and down that I would not take Calculus 1 because I would cry through the whole thing. And now I'm in Calculus 1. I got 103% on my midterm exam. And now I'm pushing for Calc 2, statistics, anything, math.
Elizabeth was convicted of armed robbery and conspiracy to armed robbery. She told us she's scheduled to be released in 2026.
We have folks serving life sentences or multiple life sentences to those individuals serving 1 year and a day.
That's Margaret Chippendale. She's the warden at the Maryland Correctional Institution for Women. It houses 800 inmates.
The public would have to spend time inside of an institution, particularly an institution such as this, because if they sat down one-on-one with these ladies, they wouldn't know who was an offender and who was a citizen.
There are about 21,000 people in Maryland's prison system. That's how many people live in Cumberland. In the last 35 years, Maryland's prison population has nearly tripled. And Maryland is not alone. According to a Human Rights Watch report released last May, state prison populations have grown more than 240% in the last 29 years.
We're one of the leaders, if not the leader in the world, in terms of the percentage of our population that's incarcerated.
That's Sandy Unger. He was the president of Goucher College until he retired in June. Goucher began the Prison Education Partnership in 2012.
We believe that when we talk about underserved populations, disadvantaged people who are not having equal access to a higher education, one of the primary populations that is neglected is the prison population, the incarcerated population of women and men.
In the 1960s in U.S. prisons, there was a real investment in rehabilitation and also education.
Keramet Ryder is a criminology professor at the University of California, Irvine. She's taught in prisons in New York, California, and Massachusetts. She says the amount of money put into educating inmates has ebbed and flowed over the years. 20 years ago, there was a shift away from investment in prison education programs. That peaked with the passage of a law taking away Pell Grants from prisoners in 1994.
Prior to that, prisoners were eligible, if they were didn't have any money to their name, which most prisoners don't, they were eligible for financial support to do both correspondence and in-prison college programs. When that support was eliminated in the 90s, a lot of existing programs shut down.
But she says that trend is changing.
I think right now we're in a period of a kind of upswing of reinvestment, both socially and with nonprofits and also government investment in thinking about how education can be put back in prison.
Many prisons have GED programs, but college degree programs have sprung up in prisons as well, including those with a liberal arts focus like Goucher's. They're run by schools like Bard College and Cornell University in New York and Grinnell College in Iowa. Some in the corrections field think that job training and skills-based education is still the best bet for incarcerated people, and that training in a trade will increase their chances of finding employment when they're released from prison. So why offer a liberal arts curriculum to inmates?
They give students the tools they need to go out and finish a college education or apply to graduate school or get further education, as opposed to some of the programs that are more geared towards job skill training, which can be much more limited.
The courses that Goucher offers at Jessup are not a cakewalk.
We're offering statistics, where we may offer pre-calculus.
Amy Rosa is the Goucher Prison Education Partnership's director.
This education that Goucher offers empowers students, whether they're up in Towson or out in Jessup, to be fully engaged politically, socially, and professionally. It's the kind of dynamic education that allows you to really make the most in a changing economy and with changing technology over your lifetime.
A cohort of 70 students are enrolled. The syllabus, the coursework, and the expectations of students are the same in both Towson and Jessup. More than 350 inmates have written letters asking how to apply to the program. That's five times more than the program has room for. And just like the pool of applicants to Goucher in Towson, not all of the students who apply meet the program's qualifications.
We offer a suite of college preparatory classes for students who are not yet ready for rigorous college work. So we'll be offering basic academic writing and either pre-algebra, algebra 1, or algebra 2 in some combination.
Liat Melnick is the program administrator of the partnership.
We're looking for students who have the time. They're actually pretty busy in prison. They have full-time jobs, so people who have the time and the commitment to do this work.
There had been, throughout the 1970s, there were a number of guerrilla groups that were sort of operating on their own, so to speak.
Professor Jeannie Murphy teaches the course on Latin American history at the men's prison in Jessup. Her 10 students consult their textbooks, take notes, and enthusiastically engage in a conversation about politics and power. Their questions and observations are insightful. Their discussion is indistinguishable from the kind of dialogue that you'd expect to hear in any college classroom. Professor Murphy has taught at Goucher College for 7 years. Her first semester at Jessup was last spring.
I had my initial doubts and just thinking, you know, why are they going to care about Latin America? And I was so pleasantly surprised right from day one. I feel almost like a sense of joy that the students have when we're having class. One day in particular that I can remember that I came in through the library instead of there in the classroom where we usually meet up. There were some doors that were locked and I came in a different way. And so I walked in and some of them were already congregating in the library. And a few of them, when they saw me, turned and said, "Jeannie!" And I said, "You know what? I would love for my students at the main campus to react like that when I walk in the room. It just doesn't happen anymore."
Teachers in Goucher's program are paid as if they were teaching a course on the Towson campus. This fall, Professor Murphy volunteers as a tutor on Monday nights, and she hopes to be able to add a Spanish class to the curriculum soon. 96% of inmates in Maryland prisons are male. Most are black. The average age is about 37. Like Cedric Nettles, he's a big guy with a bald head and a huge smile. For Professor Murphy's Latin American history class, he wrote a report about the children of the men and women who were disappeared in Argentina in the 1970s and 80s.
How long was it before they started to look into what was going on in different countries, any other countries?
pretty much nothing is done until the people who are in power and allowing that to happen lose power.
Cedric was convicted of forgery and fraud. As of this spring, he'd been at Jessup for 3 years, and he says he likely has another 3.5 to go. He's been taking classes through Goucher since 2012.
I've taken pre-algebra, Chinese philosophy, understanding politics, English 103. I'm doing English 104 and Latin American history. The Chinese philosophy and the Latin American history, it's been a real good experience for me.
He showed his paper on the children of the disappeared in Argentina to producer Stephanie Hughes.
What made you choose this topic?
Because I have a fascination with things dealing with children. You know, I'm very sentimental when it comes to children because, you know, I've seen a lot, I've been through a lot as a child myself. So I get very emotional about things with children.
Cedric projects the quiet confidence of a man who knows he's moving forward.
I plan to start my own business once I go home. And if I can get involved with Goucher College or any other college and, you know, get a little bit of business background, you know, or a business major or whatever, then that would also help me to, you know, to run my business successfully.
None of the funding for the Goucher Prison Education Partnership comes from the state or from the tuition that the students on the Towson campus pay. The inmates' tuition and books are paid for with funding from foundations and individuals who donate specifically to the program. There is evidence to suggest that it's a good investment. Once again, Keramet Ryder, a criminology professor at UC Irvine.
The data is pretty uniform that people who get an education in prison tend to have both lower recidivism rates and higher incomes and employment rates.
Though she cautions that it can be hard to find rigorous studies looking at prison education. After just a couple of years, the Goucher program doesn't yet have data on the outcomes for their students once they get out of prison. But anecdotally, they do well. The students at Jessup cannot yet receive a degree from Goucher College, but they do receive credit for the courses they pass, which appear on a Goucher College transcript. When students are released from prison, they'll be able to transfer their credits to other institutions where they can earn a degree. But for Elizabeth Snarns, who's taking the political science class, it's not just about the degree. It's a matter of engaging in the culture of college and the possibilities an education creates. It's a culture she wishes she had embraced earlier.
I think it would have opened up a completely different social, not just a social aspect for me, but a completely different way of thinking. Knowledge is definitely power, as long as the knowledge is in the right aspect.
The students at Jessup understand what it means to have doors closed on them. And now, they're learning what might happen when some of those doors begin to open.
Tom Haw, he visited Jessup with producers Matt Purdy and Stephanie Hughes last April. We've got pictures at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, an atypical story of escaping anti-Semitism in the Middle East.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. These days, the name Syria is more often than not preceded by adjectives like war-torn and devastated. It evokes images of belligerent militias, Islamic extremists, and unending civil war. It's hard now to view this land between Iraq and the Mediterranean Sea as having ever been peaceful, culturally rich, and home to tens of thousands of Jews whose families had lived there for centuries. That's the Syria, especially its northern city of Aleppo, that grounds Claudette Sutton's story of the odyssey her father and several of his brothers traveled from the Middle East to the U.S. The book is called Farewell Aleppo, My Father, My People, and Their Long Journey Home. Claudette Sutton grew up in Maryland, and her father lives in Maryland still, and they're both with me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Right off the bat, Mike Sutton, there's a mystery about how old you are, 90 or 92. Claudette, why is there a mystery about your father's age?
Because in Syria in the 20s, people didn't keep strict records of that kind of thing. The government didn't issue birth certificates. Families of Jewish boys, for instance, might have a record of the circumcision date, but they might not. So at the time that he was born, he really just had a general idea of how old he was. And then when he went to get a passport to come to the United States, his father gave a date, but it was approximate. It's hard to understand now when records are so precise for everything, but I think it's an indication of how provincial life really was in Syria at that time.
Well, Claudette, tell us some of what you've learned about the Aleppo that your father grew up in the 1920s.
I got a picture of an Aleppo that's very different from the one that you were just describing of what's going on there now. It was a provincial slow town in many ways and a very multicultural town. There was a very large Arab Muslim community, but also substantial Jewish and Christian communities. And the way Dad described it and his brothers describe it, they lived in separate neighborhoods, but were able to work and go to school together. Dad, until he left, barely 70 years ago in 1941, was going to school with Jews and Christians and Muslims in the same school. And it sounded like a city with religion infused through everyone's lives. There was a Muslim call to prayer throughout the day. The Jews were praying all day long at morning, before they ate, after they ate. It was a city with this influx of all these different religions and different ethnicities that were living alongside one another with a respectful tolerance that I think is beyond what we can even picture there today.
And what should we know about the history of Jews in Aleppo in particular? How far back does that go?
It goes back over 2,000 years. There was a Jewish community in Aleppo since the Roman times. And in fact, after the Spanish Inquisition in 1492, when so many Jews went from Spain, throughout the Mediterranean, many of them ended up in Aleppo and in Syria. Even by that time, Aleppo had a large Jewish community. It was a center of Torah scholarship at that time. That's another piece of information. You tell people now even that there were Jews in Syria, their eyebrows go up. They can't even believe that, much less how long and rich that history was.
Mike Sutton, what is your most vivid memory of being a small boy in Aleppo?
I have a lot of things to remind me. And if I get started, I could go on and on and on.
You used to get together with family all the time, it sounds like.
It's a custom that you got with the family all the time. Our holidays, that's when you see all these families.
Cousins,
during holiday.
Grandparents.
You go on.
Uncles and aunts, big family. Yeah.
Right.
This is Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Claudette Sutton and her father, Mike Sutton, who lives in Maryland. We're talking about Claudette's new book, Farewell Aleppo, My Father, My People, and Their Long Journey Home. Claudette, you write that your grandfather, Mike's father, Selim Sutton, a businessman in Aleppo, came to the decision that he had to, and that the phrase you use is, export his sons for them to be safe. Give us the background. What was going on that made your grandfather concerned about?
Sure, and that's a phrase actually from one of my dad's brothers, his brother Eli, who has written a book himself about his experiences leaving the country, alien at home. They had been living, as I described, in this tolerance with the different communities, but his father was seeing the writing on the wall that anti-Semitism was on the increase and that it would be good to get the family out of Syria. The challenge was figuring out how, because they were a large family. They had a lot of little kids. So his father couldn't leave on his own and establish somewhere else and send for the family. He couldn't get a visa for the whole family to go at once. So he came up with this plan to send the oldest sons out of the country to get established somewhere else, put down a foothold, and then be able to somehow make arrangements for the rest of the family to get out.
And the place that he sent them to was where his brother, one of his brothers, right, Joe?
Right.
Who was already in the United States, had a business, a textile exporting business in Shanghai.
In Shanghai, China, yes.
So it was in January of 1941.
Yes.
That you, Mike, and your brother, Sawa, set out for Shanghai.
He put them on a boat. They took the train together with their father to Port Said, Egypt. And then the two boys got on the ship from Port Said around the world to Shanghai to work for their uncle. And the plan, I think, as I understood it, was that they would get them that far and then hope that somehow they could get from there to the United States, however that might work itself out. Then, of course, what made that so much more complicated, this was, as you said, January of 1941 that they left. They arrived in February of 1941, and in December of 1941, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. On December 7th of 1941, on December 8th, the morning of December 8th, they marched across the Wangpo River in Shanghai and occupied Shanghai. So Dad, at that point, was living alone in Shanghai because his brother had to go back to Syria because he got sick. And his uncle went back to the United States because he could see that the war was coming. So Dad at that point was alone in Shanghai throughout the duration of the war in the Pacific under Japanese occupation. Nothing played out as it was expected to. When the war ended, Dad stayed on in Shanghai for another year or so to resume the business for his uncle and got back in contact with his family in Syria. But it became clear the options of going back to Syria were really not safe anymore. So he had to finish the plan to get to the United States. So he came to the United States on a six-month visa in May of 1947 and ended up staying in the United States, partly because at that point, what happened in Syria got to be much more dangerous for the rest of the family. After the partition of Palestine to create the State of Israel, the violence in Syria and in many of the Middle Eastern countries became really extreme and really dangerous for the Jews. And that's when the rest of his family had to find their own ways of getting out that were different and in most ways more dangerous than the circumstances of how my dad got out on a ship from Port Said to Shanghai.
And so you and several of your brothers settled in the States. You raised a family in Maryland. Do you think, given the situation in Syria today, do you expect ever to see Aleppo again?
No. No.
Does that sadden you, or is it okay?
Well, I loved my years in Syria and in Aleppo, but I can see things going back to those years in Syria.
I think it's a lot harder for me to think about the fact that we'll never see Aleppo. We may never see it. I may never see it in my lifetime. I certainly won't see the community that there was when he was growing up. I think that saddens me more because when I did this research and realized 2,000 years there was a Jewish community there, it's hard to imagine something that could exist that long and not exist anymore. That certainly throughout that history, there must have been ups and downs, but it existed. And now for it just to simply not be there is hard to get my head around. And I like to think that there's some chance sometime in the future that things could turn back, partly because it's just not that long ago that it was so different. You know, as I said, it was 70 years ago. It's living memory for many people still that there were these communities there.
It's a very interesting story that people can read in your book. I appreciate your walking us through it. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
Mike Sutton of Silver Spring. He's the protagonist of the book by his daughter, Claudette Sutton. It's titled Farewell, Aleppo, My Father, My People, and Their Long Journey Home. We've got more information about it on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.